From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This past weekend's announcement of the passing of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had Republican and Democratic politicians screeching at each other through the various talk shows over the weekend, and their respective constituents barking at each other through comments in social media. There's still more than a month until the presidential election, and lots of room for more surprises, and it's still September. For more on that, we spoke with our political analyst, Professor Tony Montero, via Skype from Philadelphia on Monday. Well, Professor Montero, let's start, I guess, with the news that broke late last week or over the weekend that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed. President Donald Trump said, I'm going to appoint another justice. As it stands on Monday, the 21st, the Republicans have enough votes to consent, and that means that Trump can put somebody on the Supreme Court. And this all happens, of course, while we're looking at an election where everybody's saying, we're not going to honor the results and we're going to slug it out, which, of course, means the Supreme Court's going to have its hands on it at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's part of it, that a 4-4 split on the Supreme Court cannot resolve what could be a contested election. And you're going to have to get that fifth vote if there is to be a constitutional or legal resolution of a crisis that can't be resolved in the political or electoral field. But then if Trump is successful in appointing a third Supreme Court justice in just his first term in office, then he will have done something that has probably not happened in recent history, a radical change in the political dynamics on the court. I think that this is what is at stake. Of course, the Supreme Court is playing an over-large role in American politics and American life because of the stalemates within the legislative branch and between the legislative branch and the presidency. In other words, lawmakers don't really make laws that much. They rely upon the Supreme Court to do what they can't or will not do. And the Supreme Court is playing an overlarge political role. Will it continue to do that? I think yes, for the foreseeable future. And therefore, the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg kind of carries with it, and that's why she was holding on, carries with it a political change on the Supreme Court that can affect multiple decisions going forward. Let me just add this. You know, in a situation where the center, where the political center has collapsed, that American politics are more divided now than they've been since the Civil War. In fact, without the Supreme Court left to fight it out on their own, the two sides would probably go to something that looks like a civil war, even with the Supreme Court playing that bigger role. That still might be the case.
Yeah, you have the stalemate at the legislative level, which reflects deep division in the electorate. That's and people, there's position A, position negative A, whatever the item might be at the time. There's about 51-49 split on almost everything across the population. Mm-hmm. And it gets exacerbated by media that more or less plays to agitate those two and sensationalize the differences. But we're talking about a center, you know, dropping out. And I understand what you mean by that, but it's a deceptive concept in the political situation in the United States, because it sounds as if it's a center between two poles, but it's not exactly that, is it?
That's interesting. You know, as you were speaking, I was thinking about, well, the working class, the immiserated, anxious, and increasingly unnecessary working class in the throes of this new technological revolution, what they broadly call the fourth industrial revolution, that is this high-tech robotics, artificial intelligence, Zooming, the situation where tens of millions, if not the majority of the U.S. workforce, can become redundant and unnecessary. In the past, the black community and the labor movement, I'd say since World War II, had played the role of shifting national politics towards the center left, towards a kind of centrist liberalism. Now, of course, with the Clinton administration and its attacks upon first the black poor through the crime bill and the welfare reform bills in 1994, the Democrats at the national level and at the presidential level and at the legislative or congressional level move from the center left to the center right. So the Democratic and Republican parties became less distinguishable. What the 2016 election in its deepest sense represented was a huge part of the working class saying that they were uncomfortable and did not accept the two parties becoming almost identical, and thus the outsider Trump is elected. I think that the 2020 election, and this is at its deepest sense, not what the media is saying, not what the political pundits or the politicians are saying, but from the standpoint of working people who are being made unemployable and unemployed, as we see with the COVID shutdown and all of that, this is an election which could decide not just the fate of the country, but the political and economic fate of millions, tens of millions of workers. In fact, the whole working class itself, including workers in what are called the service industries, like teachers, who could be unnecessary, be they in colleges or be they in public schools or whatever, because now we can Zoom the curriculum. We can Zoom classes right to your computer. And we don't need as many teachers, or maybe we don't need teachers at all. And so the fate of the working class is on the line, and so on.
And, you know, there have been people that have been making note of who's, you know, keeping score basically on who wins, who loses in the current paradigm. And one of the big winners, of course, has been Amazon and other online sellers of goods and services. As a matter of fact, we've seen almost the whole industry of yet another layer of that come into being with places that will go to your restaurant where you used to go yourself and pick up your food and drink and bring that to your house. But retail industry in particular, which has been, you know, rapidly changing over the last 20 years, we saw in 2007 one of the first presage of the collapse, the real estate collapse, was the commercial real estate, the malls in particular, that there was a collapse in the largest owners of malls in April of 2007, I think. This all a consequence, of course, of people spending less time getting in their cars and going to retail outlets and shopping online. Well, there's a huge acceleration of that since February, March of this year, when people have not been able to go to the malls at all, and they have to buy pretty much anything that they're going to buy at that kind of price online. And so they've been doing that. And the workers in the supply chains all across the board are shifting. That whole workforce is shifting. And a lot of the workers who were employed as retail sellers were union workers, and now we're looking at Amazon employees who were notoriously not that.
I think, Don, it becomes more understandable if, for one, you analyze all that is going on, be it the COVID shutdown, the COVID-produced depression that the nation is in. If you look at this from the standpoint of working people and what their future under this new technology would look like, the other side is you have to take seriously, we have to take seriously what this fourth industrial revolution, this technological revolution, and the move from a manufacturer, industrial, and retail economy to an online economy means. And thus, the potential of profits going to hundreds of trillions of dollars for the big players in the high-tech online economy. Where Detroit or Cleveland or Pittsburgh or Gary, Indiana are no longer the centers of production of wealth, but Silicon Valley. All of this is in one another way financed by Wall Street banks. So we're looking at a different economy, a capitalist economy, where money can be made without the normal economic activity, be it going to the mall or going to a job or getting out of the house or whatever. Workers are not necessary. And I have written a review that will appear in the Black Agenda Report in the next week on this book that I don't know if many people have heard about it, called Cast, The Origins of Our Discontent, by the Pulitzer Prize winning writer, Isabel Wilkerson. And I say this book is a horrible book because it shifts the focus of our thinking, or attempts to shift the focus of our thinking ideologically away from the working class and class and class divisions and conflicts to a illusory idea of caste, C-A-S-T-E, as in the Indian caste system. In other words, it's a way of arguing that racism is so congenital in the society that it's in the deep thinking of every individual. And to put it another way, we're all racist, therefore. So, except, of course, the Oprah Winfreys of the world and the high-tech trillionaires of the world, who are the most woke of the woke people, and the working class in this kind of configuration, ideological configuration, becomes the dregs of society, the quote, ugly people, the existentially expendable people. So I think
the deplorables.
The deplorables, and worse.
Right.
They got worse words for them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because they are redundant labor. They are unnecessary labor. And the 1%, or let us say the top 10% in the society, can live very, very well without the working class. This is a new stage of the class conflict. And in some ways, this election mirrors that. And just if you just look at the labor movement, organized labor, all getting behind Biden and their constituents, their members going pretty much in the other direction,
right,
either voting for Trump or not voting at all, and saying we're going to find other ways of resistance. And of course, when this breaks out into violent conflict on the streets, and the media always sides with the side that seems to be more with the Democratic Party and the Democratic nominee for president, Joe Biden, or helps his candidacy against anybody else. And so when Black Lives Matter becomes not just a matter of Black Lives Matter, but an attack upon white workers who are not Black, who say, well, what about my life? I'm poor, I don't have a job, and nobody is talking about that. And so this is the deep structure of what we are faced with, which means that November 3rd is not the end, but a beginning of a new stage of conflict in this country.
You know, back in 2015, when I was talking to people that would interview me from media, particularly foreign media, they were trying to parse what's going on over there. You got 85 people running in the Republican primary, and they're all looking to run against Hillary Clinton, who's going to win. And what's with Donald Trump and all of this? And I was telling people, well, forget about Trump. He's not serious. He's a marketing guy, and what he's doing is enhancing his brand. He's not serious. You pointed out to me, you know, the first person I heard mention this, and I was embarrassed for not thinking of it myself in a way, considering myself a Marxist. You were like, look, what you are witnessing is the phenomenon of a working class uprising in place. Mm-hmm. Where people that are in the Republican Party are standing up against what they've been enduring for the last working people, what they've been enduring for the last 30, 40 years. And their outlet is a Republican primary. Trump is the one speaking to that. He's getting lifted up. The same thing in the Democratic Party. Sanders is the one speaking to it. They're going up. The people that are outside of that, you're seeing them in the streets already. Black Lives Matter, all of the different manifestations of street activity, that this is a working class uprising in place. And so the task is, of course, to try to unify that. And of course, what's happened is we saw that Sanders got KO'd. He got the nomination stolen from him. And that split the Democratic Party sufficiently that Clinton lost the election. Trump won. He is the most powerful Republican politician in the country now by far, I think.
Maybe in the 20th century.
In the 21st century, for sure. And the people were still in the street and people were still divided. Now, with all of that being true, then we still have, you know, people that were in the Republican Party that were in the working class, they were in that largely over the question of race. That was the white backlash to the 60s, and that was the swap in the South with the Dixiecrats. When Black folks got the vote and their numbers started to be expressed through Democratic Party politics in the South, a lot of white Democrats ran to the Republican Party, where they were welcomed with open arms. And all of that stuff is where people were standing in 2016. And now we're looking at you know, the employment situation being what it is, and the situation for working people, union workers, all of that being what it is, and all of this like hangover of history, that and the massage from the media that still, you know, makes this, the divide over the electoral politics that they're selling is over race, the question of race. And the question of class is, of course, not raised at all in the public sphere because, because they don't want to.
You know, in 2016, it appeared to me clearly that you had manifested in the two parties' primaries a working class uprising. That part of the working class, for whatever reasons, had gravitated to the Republican Party, were supporting Trump, and that part of the working class in the Democratic Party, which was the traditional party of labor since FDR, gravitated towards Bernie Sanders. I think Bernie Sanders betrayed his followers, and it came back to haunt him or kick him in the butt in 2020, when, given all of the money he had and everything else, he couldn't win the nomination after Iowa and New Hampshire.
Yeah, people weren't buying it this year.
They weren't buying him this year. And so, if you remember, I spoke at the 13th anniversary of the Black Agenda Report, and the title of my presentation, Towards a Left That's Worthy of Black People and the Working Class, because the entire what is called left, be it the liberal, the social democratic, the allegedly revolutionary left, had all signed on to the anti-Trump movement, which was not just against Trump, but against that part of the working class who were voting for Trump.
Very important point.
Say that again?
That's a very, that's the essential point there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And so what is called the left and people who call themselves socialists look like more or less the armed wing of the liberals, of the Democratic Party elite,
right,
who are fighting the white part of the working class. And they're doing it without the main victims of institutional racism, black workers, right, who have not joined them. So what it then looks like is a left which is more on the side of the high-tech trillionaires than on the side of the working class who are losing their jobs, will never have jobs, and are increasingly immiserated and impoverished in this new economy.
And in addition to that, they're also aligned with the CIA, the FBI, the elites
That's
of
right.
both political parties, and the trillionaire class itself. So is a pretty odd configuration.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But it is a configuration in a situation where you have you always have to put quotes around this, a left, which is ideologically confused and is a caricature of what the left was in the late 19th and throughout the 20th century.
Right.
You have to realize that a lot of these so-called leftist organizations, their roots go back to the anti-communist period of the 20th century. In other words, they grow up or enter the political arena landscape with views that mirror the dominant political views of the ruling class, anti-communism and anti-Sovietism.
I know, you can almost ask people if they know, the particular strain that you're following, their heritage. How did the people who were selling that in 1950 feel about the Smith Act?
Yeah, well, that's true.
Okay, there were these ideological breaks over things like that that they you know, continue today, and they tell you who's who.
Well, another thing you can ask them, what stance did your political party or the political parties out of which your current political party emerges, what was your position on the Black freedom movement and the civil rights movement?
Right, that's right.
And I can guarantee you most of them were on the sidelines of it, criticizing it as a petty bourgeois or bourgeois movement.
Right.
Today, you know, you find them talking about Black Lives Matter, but when Black Lives Matter was in the streets of the South, they were not on the side of Black Lives Matter. And, you know, it's a heritage, to use the words of Lenin. It is a heritage we must renounce. That kind of anarchist, Trotskyist, anti-communist left that is now the more predominant part of the far left. That is what we have to renounce in the name of the working class as a whole. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
What we are talking about is uniting the working class at a time of desperate need for unity and resistance. And what they're talking about is exacerbating every split and division in the working class in the name of, and this is the irony of ironies, electing Joe Biden, and who has been a greater enemy in terms of policies of the working class, be it his allegiance to the credit card companies that are based in Delaware, his commitment to this globalized export of jobs throughout the world, or his support of the trillions of dollars for war in the Middle East. Anybody that claims to be left, and this in a certain sense, and I don't mean to be hyperbolic about it, anybody in the left that claims that Biden will make it more possible for us to struggle, well, if he would make it more possible, why did he not make it more possible over these 40 years of his being in politics? Yeah. Mm. So, you know, you take this array of people, everybody from Noam Chomsky to Bob Avakian and Angela Davis and Cornel West and all of their followers. I mean, what are they talking about? What are they selling to the people? And what is the working class not buying that they're selling? And I think that says to me where the left is, a left which is not anchored among working people. I don't know that we've seen anything like this since the middle of the 19th century, when Marx and Engels delivered a devastating blow to them, and of course then with Lenin and the Russian Revolution, who showed that the German social democrats had abandoned the working class. There was always this fight ideologically in the left of the past to bring the left political forces back to the working class. Now they march quite gleefully away from the working class and towards the trillionaires of the high-tech industries. It's amazing and a great irony. And I'm very happy that you create a venue where we can discuss these things critically.
I appreciate your coming here to do that, because it enhances it for sure a tremendous amount. It gets me that the things that union voters should be interested in this that have happened over the last 4 years are things like, in particular, the TPP and the TTIP,
right,
and NAFTA, all of which Trump delivered on, to everything he promised and then some. And yet the union officials are backing Biden, who hasn't spoken to any of that. But you mentioned, of course, that the union workers themselves are, you know, they're voting with their feet. So we'll come back and look at this some more next week. And who knows what's going to happen between now and then.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Don. Always a huge pleasure to be with you.
Professor Tony Montero, live to us from Philadelphia. Thank you very much. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.